The cat, a feral Ginger Tom, flicked a serrated ear and curled up in a tighter ball. Anything that could survive in Ankh-Morpork's alleys, with their abandoned swamp dragons, dog packs and furrier's agents, was not about to even open one eye for a bunch of floating nightdresses. The one who was now getting on Lady Lejeune's nerves said, "And the reason for its presence?"
"It appears to tolerate the company of apparent humans, asking nothing in return but food, water, shelter and comfort," said Lady Lejeune. "This interests me. Our purpose is to learn, and thus I have, as you can see, begun."
She hoped it sounded better to them than it did to her. One said, "When will the clock problems you spoke of be resolved?"
"Oh, soon, very soon, yes."
The one that was beginning to terrify Lady Lejeune said, "We wonder, is it possible that you are slowing the work in some way?" Lady Lejeune felt a prickling on her forehead. Why was it doing that?
"No, why should I slow the work? There would be no logic to it."
One said, And an auditor did not say, by accident. Had a very precise meaning. It went on, "You are making moisture on your head."
"Yes, it's a body thing."
One said, "Yes." And that, too, had a very specific and ominous meaning. One said, "We wonder if too long in a solid body weakens resolve. Also, we find it hard to see your thoughts."
"Body again, I'm afraid. The brain is a very imprecise instrument."
Lady Lejeune got control of her hands at last. One said, "Yes." Another said, "When water fills a jug, it takes the shape of the jug. But the water is not the jug, nor is the jug the water."
"Of course,"
said Lady Lejeune, and inside, a thought that she hadn't known she was thinking, a thought that turned up out of the darkness behind the eyes, said, "We are the most stupid creatures in the universe." One said, "It is not good to act alone." She said,
"Of course."
And once again a thought emerged from the darkness. "I'm in trouble now." One said, "And therefore you will have companions. No blame attaches. One should never be alone. Together, resolve is strengthened." Motes began to twinkle in the air. Lady Lejeune's body backed away automatically, and when she saw what was forming, she backed it away further. She had seen humans in all states of life and death, but seeing a body being spun out of raw matter was curiously disquieting when you were currently inhabiting a similar one. It was one of those times when the stomach did the thinking, and thought it wanted to throw up. Six figures took shape, blinked, and opened their eyes. Three of the figures were male, three were female. They were dressed in human-sized equivalents of the auditor's robes. The remaining auditors drew back, but one said, "They will accompany you to the clockmaker, and matters will be resolved today. They will not eat or breathe." "Huh," thought one of the little voices that made up Lady Lejeune's thinking. One of the figures whimpered.
"The body will breathe," said her ladyship. "You will not persuade it that air is not required."
She was aware of the choking noises.
"You are thinking, yes, we can exchange necessary materials with the outside world, and this is true," she went on. "But the body does not know that. It thinks it is dying. Let it breathe."
There was a series of gasps.
"And you will feel better shortly," said her ladyship,
and was enthralled to hear the inner voice think, "These are your jailers, and you are already stronger than them." One of the figures felt its face with a clumsy hand, and, panting, said, "Whom do you speak to with your mouth?"
"You,"
said Lady Lejeune. "Us?"
"This will take some explaining."
"No," said the auditor. "Danger lies that way. We believe the body imposes a method of thought on the brain. No blame attaches. It is a malfunction. we will accompany you to the clockmaker. We will do this now.
Not in those clothes, said Lady Lejeune. You will frighten him. It may lead to irrational actions.
There was a moment of silence. The auditors made flesh looked hopelessly at one another.
You have to talk with your mouth, Lady Lejeune prompted. The minds stay inside the head.
One said, What is wrong with these clothes? It is a simple shape found in many human cultures. Lady Lejeune walked to the window.
See the people down there, she said. You must dress in appropriate city fashions.
Reluctantly, the auditors did so, and while they retained the greyness, they did give themselves clothes that would pass unnoticed in the street. Up to a point, anyway.
Only those of female appearance should wear dresses, Lady Lejeune pointed out.
A hovering grey shape said, Warning, danger. The one calling itself Lady Lejeune may give unsafe advice. Warning.
Understood, said one of the incarnate ones. We know the way. We will lead.
It walked into the door. The auditors clustered around the door for a while, and then one of them glared at Lady Lejeune, who smiled.
Doorknob, she said.
The auditor turned back to the door, stared at the brass knob, and then looped the door up and down. It dissolved into dust.
Doorknob was simpler, said Lady Lejeune.
Tick. There were big mountains around the hub, but the ones towering above the temple didn't all have names, because there were simply too many of them. Only gods have enough time to name all the pebbles on a beach, but gods don't have the patience. Copperhead was small enough to be big enough to have a name. Lobsang awoke and saw its crooked peak, towering above the lesser local mountains outlined against the sunrise. Sometimes the gods have no taste at all. They allow sunrises and sunsets in ridiculous pink and blue hues that any professional artist would dismiss as the work of some enthusiastic amateur who'd never looked at a real sunset. This was one of those sunrises. It was the kind of sunrise a man rises and looks at and says, No real sunrise could paint the sky surgical appliance pink. Nevertheless, it was beautiful, but not tasteful. Lobsang was half covered in a pile of dry bracken. There was no sign of the Yeti. It was springtime here. There was still snow, but with the occasional patch of bare soil and a hint of green. He stared around and saw leaves in bud. Lutse was standing some way off, gazing up into a tree. He didn't turn his head as Lobsang approached.
Where's the Yeti? He wouldn't go further than this. Can't ask a Yeti to leave snow, whispered Lutse.
Oh, whispered Lobsang.
Why are we whispering? Look at the bird.
It was perched on a branch by a fork in the tree, next to what looked like a birdhouse, and nibbling at a piece of roughly round wood it held in one claw.
Must be an old nest they're repairing, said Lutse. Can't have got that advanced this early in the season.
It looks like some kind of old box to me, said Lobsang. He squinted to see it better.
Is it an old clock? He added. Look at what the bird is nibbling, suggested Lutse.
Well, it looks like a crude gear wheel, but why?
Well spotted. That, lad, is a clock cuckoo. A young one, by the look of it, trying to build a nest that'll attract a mate. Not much chance of that, see? It's got the numerals all wrong, and it's stuck the hands on crooked.
A bird that builds clocks. I thought a cuckoo clock was a clock with a mechanical cuckoo that came out when...
And where do you think people got such a strange idea from?
But that's some kind of miracle.
Why? Said Lutse. They barely go for more than half an hour. They keep lousy time, and the poor dumb males go frantic trying to keep them wound.
But even to... Everything happens somewhere, I suppose, said Lutse.
Not worth making too much of a fuss. Got any food left?
No, we finished it last night, said Lobsang. He added, hopefully,
I heard tell that really advanced monks can live on the, life force in the actual air itself.
Only on the planet Sausage, I expect, said Lutse.
No, we'll skirt Copperhead and find something in the valleys on the other side. Let's go, there's not much time.
But time enough to watch a bird, thought Lobsang, as he let the world around him become blue and fade, and the thought was comforting. It was easier going without the snow on the ground, provided he avoided the strange resistance offered by bushes and long grass. Lutze walked on ahead, looking oddly colourful and unreal against the faded landscape. They went past the entrance to dwarf mines, but saw no one above ground. Lobsang was glad of that. The statues he had seen in the villages yesterday weren't dead, he knew, but merely frozen at a different speed of time. Lutze had forbidden him to go near anyone, but he needn't have bothered. Walking around the living statues was invasive somehow. It made it worse when he realised that they were moving, but very, very slowly. The sun had barely moved from the horizon when they came down through warmer woods on the rim side of the mountain. Here the landscape had a more domesticated air. It was woodland rather than forest. The game trail they'd been following crossed a creek at a point where there were cart tracks, old but still not overgrown. Lobsang looked behind him after he'd walked across the ford, and watched the water very slowly reclaim the shape of his footprints in the stream. He'd been trained in time slicing on the snow fields above the valley, like the rest of the novices. That was so they couldn't come to any harm, the monks had said, although no one actually explained what harm they might come to. Outside the monastery, this was the first time Lobsang had sliced in a living landscape. It was marvellous. Birds hung in the sky. Early morning bumblebees hovered over the opening flowers. The world was a crystal made of living things. Lobsang slowed near a group of deer, cropping the grass, and watched as the nearest eye of one of them swiveled, with geological slowness, to watch him. He saw the skin move as the muscles underneath started to bunch for flight. "Time for a smoko," said Lutsang. The world around Lobsang speeded up. The deer fled, along with the magic of the moment. "What's a smoko?" said Lobsang. He was annoyed. The quiet, slow world had been fun. "You ever been to 4X? "No. There's a barman at the bunch of grapes from there, though." Lutsay lit one of his skinny cigarettes. "Don't mean much," he said. "The barman everywhere is from there. Strange country. Big time source right in the middle. Very useful. Time and space all tangled up. Probably all that beer. Nice place, though. Now, you see that country down there?" On one side of the clearing, the ground fell away steeply, showing treetops and, beyond, a small patchwork of fields tucked into a fold in the mountains. In the distance was a gorge, and Lobsang thought he could make out a bridge across it. "Doesn't look much like a country," he said. "Looks more like a shelf."
"That's which country?" said Lutze. "And we're going to borrow a broomstick. Quickest way to Ankh-Morpork. Only way to travel."
"Isn't that, interfering with history? I mean, I was told that sort of thing is all right up in the valleys, but down here in the world..."
"Oh, it's absolutely forbidden," said Lutze. "'Cause it's interfering with history. Got to be careful of your witch, of course. Some of them are pretty canny."
He caught Lobsang's expression.
"Look, that's why there's rules, understand, so that you think before you break 'em."
"But..." Lutze sighed and pinched out the end of his cigarette.
"We're being watched," he said.
Lobsang spun round. There were only trees and insects buzzing in the early morning air.
"Up there," said Lutze.
There was a raven perched on the broken crown of a pine tree, shattered in some winter storm. It looked at them, looking at it.
"Caw?"
it said. "It's just a raven," said Lobsang. "There's lots of them in the valley."
"It was watching us when we stopped. There's ravens all over the mountains, Sweeper." "And when we met the Yeti," Lutze persisted.
"That settles it, then. It's a coincidence. One raven couldn't move that fast."
"Maybe it's a special raven," said Lutze. "Anyway, it's not one of our mountain ravens. It's a lowland raven. Mountain ravens croak. They don't caw. Why is it so interested in us?"
"It's a bit weird, thinking you're being followed by a bird," said Lobsang.
"When you get to my age, you notice things in the sky," said Lutze.
He shrugged and gave a grin.
"You start worrying there might be vultures."
They faded into time and vanished. The raven ruffled its feathers.
"Croak," it said. "Damn!"
Tick! Lobsang felt around under the thatched eaves of the cottage, and his hand closed on the bristles of a broomstick that had been thrust amongst the reeds. "This is rather like stealing," he said, as Lutze helped him down.
"No, it's not," said the sweeper,
taking the broomstick and holding it up so he could look along its length.
"And I'll tell you why. If we sort things out, we'll drop it off on our way back, and she'll never know it's gone. And if we don't sort things out, well, she'll still never know it's gone. Honestly, they don't take much care of their sticks, witches. Look at the bristles on this one. I wouldn't use this to clean a pond. Oh, well, back into clock time, lad. I'd hate to fly one of these things while I was slicing."
He straddled the stick and gripped the handle. It rose a little way.
"Good suspension, at least," he said. "Now you can have the comfy seat on the back. Hold tight to my own broom and make sure you wrap your robe around you. These things are pretty breezy.
Lobsang pulled himself aboard and the stick rose. As it drew level with the lower branches around the clearing, it brought Lutse to eye level with the raven. It shifted uneasily and turned its head this way and that, trying to fix both eyes on him.
"Are you going to caw or croak, I wonder?"
said Lutse, apparently to himself.
"Croak?"
said the raven.
"So you're not the raven we saw on the other side of the mountain, then?"
"Me?
Gosh, no,"
said the raven.
"That's croaking territory over there." "Just checking."
The broom rose higher and set off above the trees in a hubwards direction. The raven ruffled its feathers and blinked.
"Damn,"
it said. It shuffled around the tree to where the death of rats was sitting.
"Squeak! Look, if you want me to do this undercover work, you've got to get me a book on ornithology, okay?"
said Quoth.
"Let's go, or I'll never keep up."
Tick. Death found famine in a fish restaurant in Genua. He had a booth all to himself and was eating duck and dirty rice.
"Oh,"
said Famine.
"It's you."
"Yes, we must ride. You must have got my message."
"Pull up a chair,"
Famine hissed.
"They do a very good alligator sausage here."
"I said we must ride."
"Why?"
Death sat down and explained. Famine listened, although he never stopped eating.
"I see,"
he said at last.
"Thank you, but I think I shall sit this one out."
"Sit it out? You're a horseman."
"Yes, of course. But what is my role here?"
"I beg your pardon?"
"No famine appears to be involved, does it? A shortage of food, per se, as such?"
"Well, no. Not as such, obviously, but..."
"So I would, as it were, be turning up just a wave. No, thank you."
"You used to ride out every time,"
said Death accusingly. Famine waved a bone airily.
"We had proper apocalypses in those days,"
he said, and sucked at the bone.
"You could sink your teeth into them."
"Nevertheless, this is the end of the world."
Famine pushed his plate aside and opened the menu.
"There are other worlds," he said. "You're too sentimental, Death. I've always said so."
Death drew himself up. Humans had created famine, too. Oh, there had always been droughts and locusts. But for a really good famine, for fertile land to be turned into a dust bowl by stupidity and avarice, you needed humans. Famine was arrogant.
"I am sorry,"
he said,
"to have trespassed on your time."
He went outside, into the crowded street, all alone. The stick swooped down towards the plains and levelled off a few hundred feet above the ground.
"We're on our way now,"
shouted Lutse, pointing ahead. Lobsang looked down at a slim wooden tower hung with complicated boxes. There was another one in the far distance, a toothpick in the morning mist.
"Semaphore towers," Lutse shouted. "Ever seen them?"
"Only in the city,"
Lobsang shouted above the slipstream.
"It's the Grand Trunk,"
the sweeper shouted back.
"Runs like an arrow all the way to the city. All we have to do is follow it."
Lobsang clung on. There was no snow beneath them, and it looked as though spring was well advanced. And therefore it was unfair that here, that much nearer the sun, the air was frigid and was being driven into his flesh by the wind of their travel.
"It's very cold up here." "Yes, did I tell you about the double-knit combinations?"
"Yes."
"I've got a spare pair in my sack. You can have them when we stop."
"Your own personal pair?"
"Yes, second best, but well darned."
"No, thank you. They've been washed."
"Lutse?"
"Yes?"
"Why can't we slice when we're on this thing?"
The tower was well past them. The next one was pencil-sized already. The black and white shutters on the boxes were twinkling in the sunlight.
"Do you know what happens if you slice time on a magically powered vehicle travelling at more than 70 miles an hour?"
"No?"
"Me neither. I don't want to find out."
Tick. Igor opened the door before the second knock. An Igor might be filling coffins with earth in the cellar or up on the roof adjusting the lightning conductor, but a caller never had to knock twice.
"Lady Thep,"
he muttered, nodding his head. He looked blankly at the six figures behind her.
"We have called to inspect progress,"
said Lady Lejeune.
"And these, ladies and gentlemen, Lady Thep?"
"My associates,"
said her ladyship, matching Igor's blank stare.
"If you would be so kind as to step inside, I will see if the master is in,"
said Igor, observing the convention that a true butler never knows the whereabouts of anyone in the house until they decide they want it to be known. He backed through the door into the workshop and then lurched into the kitchen, where Jeremy was calmly pouring a spoonful of medicine down the sink.
"That woman is here," he said, "and she hath brought lawyers."
Jeremy held out a hand palm downwards and examined it critically. "You see, Igor," he said, "here we are, almost at the completion of our great work, and I remain absolutely calm. You could build a house on my hand, it is so steady."
"Lawyers, sir,"
said Igor, giving the word some extra spin. "And?"
"Well, we have a lot of money," said Igor, with the conviction of a man who has informally secreted a small but sensible amount of gold in his own bag.
"And we have finished the clock," said Jeremy, still watching his hand.
"We've been nearly finished for days," said Igor darkly. "If it wasn't for her, I reckon we could have caught that thunderstorm 2 days ago."
"When's the next one?" Igor screwed up his face and banged his temple a couple of times with the palm of his hand.
"Unsettled conditions, with a low approaching from the rim," he said. "Can't promise anything with the soppy weather you get here. Huh! Back home, the thunderstorms come running as soon as they see you put up the iron pole. So what do you want me to do about the lawyers?"
"Show them in, of course. We have nothing to hide."
"Are you sore, sir?"
said Igor, whose carpet bag couldn't be lifted with one hand. "Please do it, Igor." Jeremy smoothed down his hair while the grumbling Igor disappeared into the shop and returned with the guests.
"Lady Lejeune, sir, and some other people," said Igor.
"It's good to see you, your ladyship," said Jeremy, smiling glassily. He vaguely remembered something he had read. "Won't you introduce me to your friends?" Lady Lejeune gave him a nervous look. Oh yes, humans always needed to know names. And he was smiling again. It made it so hard to think. Mr. Jeremy, these are my associates," she said. "Mr. Black, Mr. Green, Miss Brown, Miss White, Miss Yellow, and Mr. Blue." Jeremy held out his hand. "I'm pleased to meet you," he said. Six pairs of eyes looked uncomprehendingly at the hand. "The custom here is to shake hands," said her ladyship. In unison, the auditors extended a hand and wiggled it slowly in the air. "The hand of the other person," said her ladyship. She gave Jeremy a thin-lipped smile. "They are foreigners," she said. And she recognized the panic in their eyes, even if they didn't. "We can count the number and types of atom in this room," they were thinking. "How can there be anything in here we cannot understand?" Jeremy managed to catch one wavering hand in his. "And you are Mr.?" The auditor turned worried eyes on Lady Lejeune. "Mr. Black," she said.
"I understood that we were Mr. Black," said another male-shaped auditor.
"No, you are Mr. Green."
"Nevertheless, we would prefer Mr. Black. We are the senior, and Black is a more significant shade. We do not wish to be Mr. Green."
"The translation of your names is not, I think, important," said Lady Lejeune. She gave Jeremy another smile. "They are my accountants," she added, some reading on her part having suggested that this might excuse most oddities. "You see, Igor," said Jeremy, "they are simply accountants." Igor grimaced. Where his baggage was concerned, accountants were probably worse news than lawyers.
"Grey would be acceptable," said Mr. Green. "Nevertheless, you are Mr. Green. We are Mr. Black. It is a matter of status."
"If that is the case," said Miss White, "white is higher status than black. Black is absence of color."
"The point is valid," said Mr. Black. "Therefore we are now Mr. White. You are Miss Red."
"You previously indicated that you were Mr. Black."
"New information indicates a change of position. This does not indicate incorrectness of said previous position."
It's happening already, thought Lady Lejeune. It's in the darkness where your eyes can't see. The universe becomes two halves, and you live in the half behind the eyes. Once you have a body, you have a me. I have seen galaxies die. I have watched atoms dance. But until I had the dark behind the eyes, I didn't know the death from the dance. And we were wrong. When you pour water into a jug, it becomes jug-shaped, and it is not the same water anymore. An hour ago, they never dreamed of having names, and now they're arguing about them. And they can't hear what I think. She wanted more time. The habits of a billion years don't yield entirely to a mouthful of bread, and she could see that a crazy life form like humanity should not be allowed to exist. Yes, indeed. Certainly. Of course. But she wanted more time. They should be studied. Yes, studied. There should be reports. Yes, reports. Full reports. Long, long, full reports. Caution. That was it. That was the word. Auditors loved that word. Always put off until tomorrow something that tomorrow you could always put off until, well, let's say next year. It has to be said that Lady Lejeune was not herself at this point. She didn't quite have a grip of herself to be. The other six auditors, in time, yes, they'd think the same way. But there wasn't time. If only she could persuade them to eat something, that would... Yes, that would bring them to their senses. There seemed to be no food around, though. She could see a very large hammer on the bench. "How is progress, Mr. Jeremy?" she said, walking over to the clock. Igor moved very fast and stood almost protectively next to the glass pillar. Jeremy hurried forward. "We have carefully aligned all the systems." "Again," Igor growled. "Yes, again. Several times, in fact," Igor added. "And now we simply await the right weather conditions." "But I thought you stored lightning." Her ladyship indicated the greenish glass cylinders bubbling and hissing along the wall of the workshop. "Just by the bench with, yes, the hammer on it." And no one could read her thoughts. The power. "There will easily be enough to keep the mechanism working, but to start the clock will require what Igor calls a jump," said Jeremy. Igor held up two crocodile clips the size of his head.
"Right," he said, "but you hardly ever get the right kind of thunderstorm down here. Sort of built this in Oberwald, I kept saying."
"What is the nature of this delay?" said "Possibly, Mr. White." "We need a thunderstorm, sir, for the lightning," said Jeremy. Lady Lejeune stepped back a little closer to the bench.
"Well, arrange one," said Mr. White.
"Huh. Well, if we were in Oberwald, of course."
"It is merely a matter of pressures and potentials," said Mr. White. "Can you not simply create one?"
Igor gave him a look of disbelief mixed with respect.
"You're not from Oberwald, are you?" he said.
Then he gasped and banged the side of his head.
"Hey, I felt that one," he said. "Whoops! How did you do that? Pressure dropping like a stone."
Sparks glittered along his black fingernails. He beamed.
"I'll just go and raise the lightning rod," he said,
hurrying to a pulley system on the wall. Lady Lejeune turned on the others. This time she wished they could read her thoughts. She didn't know enough pronounceable human swear words.
"That is against the rules," she hissed.
"Mere expediency," said Mr. White. "If you had not been lax, this would have been concluded by now."
"I counseled further study."
"Unnecessary."
"Is there a problem?" said Jeremy, in the diffident voice he used for conversations not involving clocks.
"The clock should not be started yet," said Lady Lejeune, not taking her eyes off the other auditors. "But you asked me. We've been... It's all set up. There may be problems. I think we should see another week of testing."
But there weren't problems, she knew. Jeremy had built the thing as if he'd built a dozen like it before. It had been all Lady Lejeune could do to spin things out this long, especially with Igor watching her like a hawk.
"What is your name, young person?" said Mr. White to Jeremy.
The clockmaker backed away. "Jeremy," he said, "and I don't understand, Mr. White.
A clock tells the time. A clock isn't dangerous. How could a clock be a problem? It's a perfect clock.
Then start it.
But, Her Ladyship, the door knocker thundered. Igor!
Yes, sir,
said Igor from the hallway.
How did the servant person get there? Said Mr. White, still watching Her Ladyship.
It's a sort of trick they have, said Jeremy. I'm sure it's only...
It's Dr. Hopkins, sir,
said Igor, entering from the hall.
I told him you were busy, but...
But Dr. Hopkins, although apparently as mild-mannered as milk, was also a guild official, and had survived as such for several years. Ducking under Igor's arm was no problem at all for a man who could handle a meeting of clockmakers, no two of whom exactly ticked in time with the rest of humanity. I just happened to have business this way, he began, smiling brightly, and it was no trouble to drop in at the apothecary to pick up... Oh, you have company. Igor grimaced, but there was the code to think of.
Shall I make some tea, sir?
He said, as all the auditors glared at the doctor.
What is this tea? Mr. White demanded.
It is a protocol, snapped Lady Lejeune. Mr. White hesitated. Protocol was important. Yes, said Jeremy. Tea, Igor, please, please.
My word, I see you finished your clock, said Dr. Hopkins, apparently oblivious of an atmosphere that could float iron. What a magnificent piece of work.
The auditors stared at one another as the doctor ambled past them and looked up at the glass face. Well done indeed, Jeremy, he said, removing his glasses and polishing them enthusiastically. And what is this pretty blue glow?
It's the crystal ring, said Jeremy. It spins light, said Lady Lejeune. And then it makes a hole in the universe.
Really? Said Dr. Hopkins, putting his glasses back on.
What an original idea. Does a cuckoo come out?
Tick. Of the very worst words that can be heard by anyone high in the air, the pair known as uh-oh possibly combined the maximum of bowel-knotting terror with the minimum wastage of breath. When Lutse uttered them, Lobsang didn't need a translation. He'd been watching the clouds for some time. They were getting blacker and thicker and darker.
The handle's tingling, shouted Lutse. That's because there's a storm right above us, screamed Lobsang. The sky was as clear as a bell a few minutes ago.
Ankh Morpork was much closer now. Lobsang could make out some of the taller buildings and see the river snaking across the plain, but the storm was coming up all around the city.
I'm going to have to land this thing while I can, Lutse said. Hold on.
The stick dropped until it was a few feet above the cabbage fields. The plants were a rushing green blur inches below Lobsang's sandals. Lobsang heard another word that, while not the worst you can hear while airborne, is not at all good when it's said by the person steering.
Do you know how to stop this? Screamed Lobsang. Not in so many words, shouted Lutse. Hold on, I'm going to try something.
The stick tilted up, but kept moving in the same direction. The bristles dipped into the cabbages. It took the width of a field to slow down, at the end of a furrow, with the smell that only squashed cabbage leaves can yield.
How fine can you slice time?
The sweeper said, scrambling over the battered plants.
I'm pretty good, Lobsang began.
Get better, quick.
Lutse faded to blue as he ran towards the city. Lobsang caught him up within 100 yards, but the sweeper was still fading, still slicing time thinner and thinner. The apprentice gritted his teeth and followed, straining every muscle. The old man might be a fraud when it came to fighting, but there was no kidding here. The world went from blue to indigo to an inky, unnatural darkness like the shadow of an eclipse. This was deep time. You couldn't stay there long, he knew. Even if you could tolerate the ghastly chill, there were parts of the body that just weren't designed for this. Go too far down, too, and you'd die if you came back too quickly. He hadn't seen it, of course, no apprentice had, but there were some quite graphic drawings in the classrooms. A man's life could become very, very painful if his blood began to move through time faster than his bones. It would also be very short.
I can't keep this up, he panted, running after Lutse in the violet gloom. You can, gasped the sweeper. You're fast, right? I'm not trained for this.
The city was getting closer.
No one's trained for this, growled Lutse. You do it, and you find out that you're good at it.
What happens if you find out you're no good, said Lobsang. The going felt easier now. He no longer had the feeling that his skin was trying to drag itself off him.
Dead men don't find things out, said Lutsay. He turned his head to his apprentice, and his evil grin was a yellow-toothed curve in the shadows. Getting the hang, he added.
I'm on top of it.
Right, then, now that we've warmed up. To Lobsang's horror, the sweeper faded further into the dark. He called up reserves he knew he didn't have. He screamed at his liver to keep up, thought that he felt his brain creak, and plunged on. The shape of Lutsay lightened as Lobsang drew level with him in time.
Still here. One last effort, lad.
I can't. You bloody well can. Lobsang gulped freezing air and fell onwards, where the light was suddenly a calm, pale blue, and Lutsay was trotting gently between the frozen carts and unmoving people around the city's gate.
See? Nothing to it, said the sweeper. Just maintain, that's all. Nice and steady.
It was like balancing on a wire. It was fine if you didn't think about it. But all the scrolls say you go blue and violet and into the black, and then you hit the wall, said Lobsang.
Ah, oh, well, scrolls, said Lutsay,
and left it there. This is the tone of the voice said it all.
This is Zimmerman's Valley, lad. It helps if you know it's here. The abbot said it's something to do with, what was it? Oh, yeah, boundary conditions. Something like the foam on the tide. We're right on the edge, boy.
But I can breathe easily.
Yeah, shouldn't happen. Keep moving about, though, otherwise you'll exhaust all the good air around your body field. Good old Zimmerman, eh? One of the best he was. And he reckoned there was another dip even closer to the wall, too.
Did he ever find it?
Don't think so.
Why?
The way he exploded gave me a hint. Don't worry. You can maintain the slice easily here. You don't have to think about it. You've got other things to think about. Keep an eye on those clouds.
Lobsang looked up. Even in this blue-on-blue landscape, the clouds over the city looked ominous.
It's what happened back in Oberwald, said Lutsay. The clock needs a lot of power. The storm blew up out of nowhere.
But the city's huge. How can we find a clock here?
First, we're going to head for the centre, said Lutsay.
Why?
Because, with luck, we won't have to run so far when the lightning strikes, of course.
Sweeper, no one can outrun lightning. Lutsay spun round and grabbed Lobsang by the robe, dragging him closer.
Then tell me where to run, speedy boy, he shouted. There's more to you than meets the third eye, lad. No apprentice should be able to find Zimmerman's Valley. It takes hundreds of years of training, and no one should be able to make the spinners sit up and dance to his tune the very first time he sees them. Think I'm daft, do you? Orphan boy, strange power, what the hell are you? The mandala knew you.
Well, I'm just a mortal human, and what I know is I'll be damned if I'll see the world shattered a second time. So, help me.
Whatever it is you've got, I need it now. Use it.
He let go and stood back. A vein in his bald head was throbbing.
But I don't know what I can do to... Find out what you can do.
Tick. Protocol. Rules. Precedent. Ways of doing things. That's how we've always worked, thought Lady Lejeune. This and this must follow that. It has always been our strength. I wonder if it can be a weakness. If looks could have killed, Dr. Hopkins would have been a smear on the wall. The auditors watched his every move like cats watching a new species of mouse. Lady Lejeune had been incarnate much longer than the others. Time can change a body, especially when you've never had one before. She wouldn't have stared and fumed. She would have clubbed the doctor to the ground. What was one more human? She realized, with some amazement, that the thought there was a human thought. But the other six were still wet behind the ears. They hadn't yet realized the dimensions of duplicity that you needed to survive as a human being. They clearly found it hard to think inside the little dark world behind the eyes, too. Auditors reached decisions in concert with thousands, millions of other auditors. Sooner or later, they'd learn to be their own thinkers, though. It might take a while, because they'd try to learn from one another first.